Okay. So today we're going to start talking, we'll talk briefly about stability. I'll mention to you guys, a big part of this chapter is dedicated to a particular method that, while useful to know about, I've actually never used on a quote-unquote real problem. So we're not going to spend a whole lot of time going through the details of it. It was super useful before we had effectively infinite computational power, when you had to solve all these problems by hand. And we'll see kind of why that's the case in the kind of really high-level overview we'll do of it. But we won't go into detail. So the most of Chapter 6 is actually outlining that method and a couple of examples of that method. So we're just going to, you should know about it. But I'm not going to ask you guys to solve any kind of problems using that particular method. So it is actually a method to determine stability. What does it mean for a system to be stable? I think colloquially, maybe. In the controls terminology, not quite.
Stable, I mean, it's just the opposite of unstable, so it's not going to get to a point where it's just out of control, like stability would be within control.
Okay, so within control, I think that's probably a good idea. It doesn't go out of control.
It doesn't go to infinity?
Yeah, the response doesn't go off to infinity, actually. So I think this is kind of one common problem, and I actually yell at my grad students all the time about this, is if we're talking about control system stability, we mean a very specific thing, right? And we need to be, if you're giving technical presentations and talking about technical topics, which you all will be for the rest of your careers, most likely, you need to be careful about the kind of colloquial meaning of a word versus the technical meaning of a word. And stable is one of those. So we talk about something being stable, kind of colloquially, it doesn't fall over easy. That's some kind of stability, right? But it doesn't go crazy, right? But in control, stability has a really specific meaning, right? And what we tend to mean, basically, is given a bounded input, meaning the input doesn't go off to infinity, our output doesn't go off to infinity. All right. So a stable system could be sitting here oscillating forever if I had an input that was forcing it to do that forever, back and forth. And it could be oscillating a lot forever, right? Which I think might disagree with the colloquial meaning of stability. If it's moving around and swaying, given some input, right? But from our controls perspective, that would be a stable system because the output is bounded. It's not growing off to infinity, given that we had a bounded input. Okay. So you also hear this called bounded input, bounded output stability, BIBO stability. You'll see some textbooks and some papers. If you're reading academic papers, we'll refer to it as that. Right. And there's still this huge effort in controls research to determine if systems are stable or not, given some kind of fancy controller or some kind of weird dynamics about the system. Right. So that's what it means for a system to be stable. Given a bounded input, the output of the system is also bounded. So then, what does it mean to be unstable? Output. Yeah, it's not bounded. It can grow up to infinity. All right. We've talked about this a little bit already, but what are some conditions that tell us whether the system is stable? We already have some of these analysis tools.
Poles and zeros.
Poles and zeros. What about the poles and zeros?
Where they lie on the real.
Okay. So, I don't want to write this. So, okay. So tell me that one more time.
Where the poles and zeros lie on the real axis.
Okay. Where they need to be for a stable system.
Closer to imaginary.
On the left side of the imaginary axis.
There we go. So as long as the pole is in the left half plane, in the S plane, it's stable. Okay. So when we say left half plane, I'll draw a quick one up real quick. All right, so like that, that's a stable pole. Right. These guys are stable poles. Right. These guys, infinitely close to the axis, are stable poles. And we'll get to the special case in just a second. What if they actually lie on the axis? As long as you're in the left half plane, so the real part of your pole is negative. All right. So that's if we're working kind of from the transfer function perspective. And you guys know what it means from the kind of state space perspective? We have that A matrix in the state space, right? Haven't really talked about that one, right? So are all negative. So I can get some information about my stability by looking at the eigenvalues of the A matrix in that state space form. Right. You guys remember the state space form? Is what?
AX plus
BU. Right. Yeah, so if I look at kind of the input type equation, I'll get something like that. So I can look at this A matrix. And if take the eigenvalues of that and find the eigenvalues all have negative real parts, then the system is also stable. All right. And we'll see moving forward, maybe 2 weeks, that these things are kind of telling us the same thing, and what these eigenvalues tell us a lot about our system response in the same way that the pole locations do.
The eigenvalues are what exactly?
That's a very good question. Anybody had linear algebra? Nobody? Okay. So eigenvalues, if I take the determinant, you know the determinant?
Yes.
Okay. If I set the determinant, the determinant of A. Let me ask you to just hold on to that a second. I'm going to confuse you by trying to do it in 30 seconds, as opposed to when we actually get to looking at those eigenvalues, we'll spend more time on it. All right. So basically, they tell us, if you think about it, they'll actually get us right to the characteristic equation of the system, taking the eigenvalues of that A matrix. So the same way that looking at the transfer function and solving for the characteristic equation gets you to the poles, looking at the eigenvalue, eigenvector analysis of the A matrix gets you to the characteristic equation, which gets you to eigenvalues, eigenvectors, gets you to pole locations as well. Right? So it's all related. It's just different ways of writing the same stuff, basically. Right? And that should make sense, right? Because these, whether you write it in transfer function form or write it in state space form, are still describing the same system. Right? So there should be some relationship there. Right, the stability is a property of the system, not how I write it. Okay. Okay. So we have all these stable poles here. Let me get rid of these for right now. And let's say we have some poles that are exactly on the imaginary axis. What can we say about that system? Undamped. What else can you say about it?
It's unstable.
It's unstable.
It's going to be
It has some kind of oscillation, but does that mean it's unstable?
Does it mean it'll tend towards infinity? It might just oscillate
okay.
in a finite
bound. Sure. So there are some inputs where, given the bounded input, we have a bounded output. Right? Is there any input that's bounded that this system would have an unbounded output?
Yes?
Okay, what is it?
Maybe like a ramp input or a parabolic input, depending on the transfer function?
Not quite. What happens if I force a system right at its natural frequency? System has some natural frequency, right? Now, at my forcing function, I try to move it back and forth at exactly its natural frequency.
Like with an impulse?
No, I have some sinusoidal harmonic input.
Oh, you get like resonance?
Yeah, resonance.
So in resonance.
Right. So the Tacoma-Nowers bridge is a good example of that. Right. So the wind was blowing, excited that bridge at exactly one of its natural frequencies. So despite the wind being a bounded input, right, it kept blowing at, and exciting at this natural frequency until the bridge broke and fell down. So for this system, if you force that system exactly at that frequency, and actually you could have other poles over here, and still if you pick this frequency and force exactly that frequency, the output's going to be unbounded. All right. What happens for all other inputs? We kind of said that point already.
Bounded.
It's bounded at all other inputs. All right. So for all other inputs, the output is bounded. So we actually have a special name for these guys. So if you have poles right on, and these are called marginally stable poles. Because they're not stable all the time. But for most inputs, they actually are going to be. Okay, so we have some idea of our concept of stability. It's going to be really important, not just in analyzing systems, but we can pick actually controllers for systems that will drive the system unstable. All right, so if we don't choose our controller correctly, then we could actually force the system to be unstable, even if it was naturally stable before. Right, so this idea of stability comes up in controls and is a really important concept. And still, like I said, still an active area of research, looking at provable stability for some complex control structure or some complex dynamic system, right, where it's not so easy to actually map out what the poles and zeros are or solve that eigenvalue problem. Okay, so do you guys see any difficulty with this analysis so far? If I was going to do, I give you some random system, would you be able to tell if it's stable or not? Let's say random, I give you the equations of motion. Yeah, so I can find the transfer function, I can get the poles, or I can get the eigenvalues if I decide to go state space form. How much work is that?
A lot. For a complex system, a lot.
You can probably just estimate it by getting the system type.
Right? We can find out some stuff, yeah. But yeah, the short answer is this can end up being a lot of work, right? Particularly if you move beyond, like the systems, even the ones in your guys' homework, are simple, right? Those are textbook examples, right? So if you have a really high order transfer function, right? You guys are dealing with second order, third order, maybe a fourth order guy, right? You can have systems that are much higher than that, and system A matrix that have, depending on your system, hundreds of rows. Trying to solve that eigenvalue problem, right? Or trying to find 100 poles can be not so easy, right? Particularly if it's 1960 and you don't have infinite computing power at your disposal, effectively. Right? So the method that kind of was developed kind of simultaneously by my two controls researchers, basically attempted to determine method or criterion. Yep, stability criterion. Section 6.2. So these controls researchers and maybe even math researchers figured out that we can actually get some information of where the poles of the system are located, or the poles of the characteristic equation more generally, are located by kind of doing this kind of matrix type weird stuff. And that's computationally simpler than actually figuring out the pole locations and solving the characteristic equation directly. Right. So while this method was super useful 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it's not so useful anymore. Right. In that it takes us 30 seconds to get the poles of a system computationally, including us having to type it in. Right. So the finding the poles part, this method, the stability criterion, is effectively a shortcut to doing this and figuring out if there are all the poles in the left-hand plane. Okay. And again, I think, in my opinion and the survey of folks at the conference last week that I talked to, their opinion as well, the usefulness of this is kind of past. And that we can solve for those pole locations pretty easily. All right. So there's a whole section and examples of your book. Dedicated to that, know about it, know if someone you got to work in a controls job says Ralph Hurwitz, at least know what they're talking about, right? Know that you can go look up how to do it if you actually need to. And again, I've actually never personally used this on a quote-unquote real problem. So I'm not going to make you guys do it either. But know of it at least. Okay. And that finishes off chapter 6. So let's go to chapter 7. Chapter 7 is also an oldish method that happens to still be useful, but in a different way than it probably used to be. So let's talk about it. Okay. So, root locus method is a method that allows us to plot how the pole and zero locations change as we change different parameters in our transfer function. Right. So we can take our pole zero map, let's say, and maybe I have some guys there, and a zero there, and as I change the gain of my controller, for example, these poles are going to move in some way. Right. So where do they go? Do they end up over here as I increase the gain? Or do they kind of move this way as I increase the gain? Right. So what a root locus lets us do is figure out kind of how these guys move in space as I change the parameter. And most often it's a gain in your controller or some constant that's the ratio of the gains or something like that. Okay. So and there are ways to solve for this root locus directly, right? You certainly could plug in the parameter, get your poles and zeros, plot those, plug in the parameter, the next value of your parameter, plot your poles and zeros and get those and step through the whole range of parameters you want to look at. Right? You don't really want to do that usually, although that's, if you call this method in the control system toolbox, that's effectively what it's doing. But we also can, where, you know, that method, that way of solving it was probably way more useful, again, 20 or 30 years ago. Right. Where you'll see the root locus used more often here is getting quick sketches and information about how the system's going to behave as that parameter changes. Right. So what we'll see, and we'll get good at sketching these things, right? And there are some really common ones, so you'll kind of start recognizing shapes. And you can see, well, how is the system changing? How is the system response changing? Remember, those pole zero locations don't just tell us about stability. They tell us something about the system response. So if I have a map of them as I change a parameter, I can see how the response is changing as I change that parameter as well. So even in kind of a 30-second sketch, I can start getting some intuitive understanding, oh, yeah, I want to increase my proportional gain. Or if I increase my gain too much, it's going to go unstable, so I better be careful when I'm tuning this thing. Right? And we'll be able to do that again in like 30 seconds if we can sketch a pole. If we know the pole and zero locations, we'll be able to sketch a root locus. Right? So let's talk through what exactly is happening and what's the kind of... We'll get a little bit of the background of why the kind of procedure to sketch a root locus works, and then we'll start sketching some. Okay. So let's look at a transfer function, our kind of standard feedback control system. And I'm just going to say we have a constant parameter there in our control block. I call this guy G. Input R, output Y. Our standard, we have some gain here that's proportional to the error. Our input to the original plant is proportional to the error. This is what we'll find out to be called a proportional controller. Okay, what is the closed loop transfer function of this? Right, so if I'm looking at that, where are the poles located? Or what do I need to do to find out where the poles are located? Anybody? Yeah.
Find the zeros in the characteristic equation.
Okay, so what's the characteristic equation here?
1 plus kg.
Okay, so... And what I set that equal to?
Zero.
Equals zero. All right. So if I do that, for that to be true, I'm going to go a little bit, not quite as far as you went. I'm going to do that. Negative one, you're right. All right. So this is an equation in that S domain. Right? And we know that actually, you know, this G is some function of S. No, S is actually an imaginary number. So this is a complex equation. So I could also, for example, right, so I can write, well, let me ask you guys, how else could I write this equation? So I have some complex equation equals minus 1. I'm trying to solve for some complex number. Yeah, I could do that. Right. I also can write it in this kind of magnitude and angle form, right? This polar, essentially polar form of complex variables. Right. So if I'm going to do that, what does that need to be?
One.
What does that need to be? Okay, let's do it this way. So I have real, imaginary. Okay, we said we need the magnitude to be 1, right? So that defines some circle, right, where the magnitude is 1, okay? But to get to the minus 1, where does the angle need to be? Yeah. So it actually needs to be over here, basically, if we're looking at the parameter, just a random imaginary cup, right? So we'll see that that actually, 180, what else could it be? Negative 180, what else could it be? Well, 0 is going to be over here. Any other numbers we're going to nail out? Well, if I do 180, I know it needs to be here. So 180, how do I get back to there? Add 360 to it. Right. So the angle can be that, right? It can be this angle. I can go around k different times. As long as I stop over here, I still have the same angle. All right. So we have now two equations, right? And remember this is an equation in S. That G has some S stuff embedded in it, right? It's a polynomial in S. So solving as I vary K and solve these guys for S, I get the locus of points. Okay. Does that seem any easier than solving the pole locations directly in some iterative manner? No. I got to vote for no. I agree with that one. All right. So this is the underpinning of why the real locus works, is that we're essentially plotting these pole locations on this complex plane while satisfying these two locations, these two equations as k is varied. Because right. These have to both be true in order for this equation to be true. All right. Let's look a short, let's consider a sample. Let's let what do we want to let G be? GB that. All right. So then what's our closed loop transfer function? So just plugged in G there and simplify or collect the terms. So what's the characteristic equation of this system?
S squared plus 2s plus k.
So you'll start off and see that it's written as like a delta S. Have that equal to 0. All right. So if you want to find the locus of points as I vary k in this equation, that's what I have to vary, right? That's my kind of control parameter here. I get to tweak that knob with the system. What should k be? What can I do? I talked through a couple methods already. So I have some range of values I might be able to pick for k. Right? And let's say they're all positive, which they generally are. All right, so I can start with some value of k, solve this directly, figure out what the pole locations are, plot those poles. All right, pick the next little value of k, solve this equation again, plot those poles in my pole zero map. And it's looped through a whole range of k values that I want to look at. I can also solve this equation. All right, so I can take and solve. But look, this is just operating on the open loop transfer function. So in this case, I actually have solve that instead if I want to. And this could be easier depending on your system. But solving this, picking a value of k, solving that, picking a value of k, solving this, it's not so much of a trade-off. But the locus would be the values of s that satisfy this that equation or these two equations as I vary k. So kind of wanted to go through all this just to kind of point out that this root locus idea, all it's doing is plotting the pole locations as something changes in my transfer function. Right. So in this case, again, I get to tweak. K is the knob I have to change on this control system. Right, as I'm trying to design the controller. Right. I want to see how does the system performance change as I tweak K. I turn the knob on K. Right. Pole zero map gets me a long way towards doing that, right? If we know the pole locations, we know natural frequency, we know damping ratio. If we have those two things, we can get to steady, we can get to overshoot, settling time, all those kind of things, right? So if I have the pole location, as I vary K, I can pick out a good K. And what the root locus attempts to do is give us a method to map out how those pole locations change as my value changes. Right. And so far, it doesn't look so much easier than just plugging in values of k and figuring out what the best thing looks like. Well, it gets easier, hopefully, judging on your faces. All right, so let's talk about the procedure to sketch a root locus. And it's not going to be solve these directly. All right. That is one procedure, but we're not going to do that. Okay. All right, so what we're going to do first over the next 10 minutes or so is just kind of breeze through a very high level what are the steps we're going to take. And then we're going to work a couple of examples that go through those steps and kind of outline how do we actually implement those steps. Okay. So, step one in your book's terminology has a bunch of subparts to it. And basically it's high level objective is that. Step one in kind of your book's framework is just preparing to plot the root locus and beginning to plot what we know right away. Well, from that, we need to write the system in the kind of appropriate form. Right. You need it in a form that's something like that for this to work. Okay. What you want to do then if it's not done already, which it will be for a relatively large number of your textbook problems, factor the numerator and denominator of G so that we can write that do plus, I think your book does plus, yeah. I think he's using J, yeah. So we have M zeros, N poles. And remember that big pi sign is a product. So we've just factored the numerator and denominator and figured out what the poles and zeros are in the in G itself. Okay. C of 1. Plot the open loop poles and zeros on a pole zero map. Where do we get those from? Based on this. What's the open loop transfer function here?
KG.
KG, right? So our open loop poles and zeros, that's why we got the product, that's why we factored those two guys here. Right? So that's our minus ZIs and minus PJs. All right, and then finally D, we'll see that the root locus actually can have multiple branches, multiple loci, right? So for nearly every system we're going to work on, the number of separate loci, which is why your book uses SL for this parameter, is equal to the number of poles, provided you have more poles than zeros. And again, nearly every system you're going to work on, particularly in this class, that will be true. So if you have more poles and zeros, the number of separate loci on your plot is going to be equal to the number of poles. Okay. That's all step one. That's all just kind of getting stuff ready. There's a little bit of math, I guess, and then figuring out how to factor the thing. How to factor g. But now we can start plotting the actual locus itself. Okay. So on the real axis, if you have poles or zeros on the real axis, right, on the real axis, the locus exists to the left of odd numbers of poles plus zeros. Okay. So I'll just sketch that real quick. We'll have an example coming up. Say I have a pole there, a zero there, a pole there. Okay. So start at the imaginary axis. Okay. Well, I have zero poles. Then I have one. So it's to the left of that. I get to the zero. Now I have two. This way, so I get over here, now I have three, looks that way. Okay. So it's to the left of odd numbers. So I have one pole to the left of that, I get to that one, now I have two, so there's nothing in between these two. I get to this one, I have three, so everything to the left of that is on the locus. Make a little bit of sense? Yes? So we're going to sketch that part of the locus. If we have, that's if you have poles or zeros on the real axis. You're not guaranteed to. But if you have those, go ahead and sketch them. You can go ahead and sketch that part of the locus already. Okay. These loci are going to be defined by asymptotes. Those asymptotes are going to break away from the real axis at this place, sigma A. Minus. And their angle from the real axis is defined by this angle. And minus it minus one. You have more than one asymptote from a particular breakout point. Okay, so just the asymptotes. We're going to find where it crosses the imaginary axis. There's actually a couple different ways we can do that. Why is that one important? Where the locus crosses the imaginary axis.
That's where you start to get unstable.
That's where you go unstable. Right. So we need to, that's a really important point in all of this. At what value of k do I cross over into instability? And in practice, what value of k am I even getting close to being unstable? Five. We're gonna find our breakaway points. There may be none, actually. And the breakaway points are where the locus leaves the real axis. Okay, so if you have like an earlier sketch, and we'll hopefully get to a problem today, that has some components on the real axis, at some point it's possible to break away from that axis and the locus goes away from the real axis. Right. They're called breakaway points. And the way you get that is basically set. Actually, we'll save that to the example. Well, that's our next step. If we have complex departure angle. Okay. So if you have complex conjugate poles or zeros, oscillatory poles, right? We'll find the departure angle from them or the arrival angle if we have complex zeros. So all this sketches out kind of landmarks on this root locus for us. We get through 6 and then step 7 is to actually draw the darn thing. So again, I know I'm not completely explaining all these, but I just want to walk through what the procedure is. You can follow this and you're going to get a root locus. All right. So let's look at some examples. I'll leave up our steps over there. We'll do something that's pretty similar to example 7.1. So we have I've kind of already done, let's see, step 1A. We already have it kind of in the right form. We've already done step 1B. We have it factored. Right. Step 1C, let's do that. Let's leave ourselves enough room to do this. Might not need that much. Okay, so where do I have zeros? All right. Where do I have poles? Okay. So we'll generally draw, I think we thought before, poles as X's, zeros as O's. So we have one pole at 0. We have 0 there. Right. So we have our poles and zeros. That's 1C. All right. How about 1D? How many, do we have more poles than zeros? Yes. Yes. So we know we're going to have n separate loci. What's n here?
Two.
So we're going to have two separate loci here. Okay. So save that. So now we want to, let's move on to step 2. Okay, looks pretty similar to the one I sketched out, but let's walk through it again. So the loop, the locus exists to the left of odd numbers of poles plus zeros. Right. So if I look over here, I have 0 poles or zeros that I would be to the left of. So there's nothing there. Right. If I look between here, this kind of segment, there's one pole that I would be to the left of. So we know it kind of exists in here somewhere. Right? All the way out to the zero. If I'm in this segment, I have two poles plus zero is even, so I know it doesn't exist in this segment. Go to the final segment, I know there are one, two, three poles plus zeros that I would be to the left of, so I know it exists there. So I know I have a segment here, and I know I have a segment there. Okay. And for this particular case, what we see is the rest of it doesn't really matter. I have my two branches. And we can kind of know it doesn't matter. We can work through that, and you end up getting actually values that match up exactly with what we've drawn so far. Or you can just trust me for right now. I think just trust me so we can get to a more interesting example. The other thing I want to point out here that I forgot to back over there somewhere is that on the root locus, as you vary your parameter, in this case k, the closed loop poles is what we're plotting on the locus. Notice that our X's and O's here are the open loop ones, right? Okay. So as we're varying the parameter and plotting this locus, which is the closed loop poles, they start at the open loop pole and go towards open loop zeros. And in this case, we actually have an open loop zero at infinity. So, again, these X's and O's you'll see in a root locus are the open loop poles and zeros. Right? We plotted those straight from KG. Right? What the locus is, let me make this point strong enough earlier, I think, is the location of the closed loop poles as we vary K. Right? So, right here, if K is near zero, we have the open loop case. And then as we vary k, increasing k, we go from open loop pole toward open loop zero. The closed loop poles do. All right. Kind of simple example. I think the book goes through, actually calculates some of this other stuff and shows that it makes sense for that plot. Okay. Got enough time to at least set this one up. I'll leave the steps up so we can refer back to them. And we're going to need this, so might as well leave it up. Draw reasonably straight. Okay. So we've got another example. We're going to have the same type control structure we drew earlier. But in this case, we have that. Okay. A characteristic equation would be that still. For this particular example, right? So we had the same block diagram we drew up earlier. I don't think we need to redraw it. Okay. So we can write that. We've already taken care of steps 1A. B, about C, all right? Where do we have poles or zeros?
No zeros, right?
No zeros.
And poles at 0, -1, -2.
Right. Okay. What else can we do right away? Step two, while we're over here plotting stuff. Yeah, on the real, with the real axis parts of these loci. All right. So where are they going to be? Yeah, between 0 and negative 1. And then that goes out forever, right? Over here, there's always an odd number of poles or zeros that I'd be to the left of. So that keeps going out to infinity. Okay? We skipped kind of 1D there. How many loci am I going to have on my plot?
Three.
Yeah, somebody said, yeah. We got three. We got three poles. We have more poles than zeros. So I can look at my locus I have already, and I know there's going to be some other stuff here that we didn't have before. Right? Because right now we only have two separate loci on the plot. And our 1D is telling us, oh, we need three. All right? So there's something else happening. I'm going to say, let's move on to step three. Okay. Step three, we're going to sketch some asymptotes. Right? And for us, that's what's going to define our third branch in this locus. Okay. So these asymptotes are going to start at the sigma A parameter, which is the sum of the poles. So we can just do that. So in that case, we have what? 0, minus 1, minus 2. Right. Okay. Minus the zeros. We have any zeros? Nope. Over number of poles minus number of zeros. So we have 3 minus 0. 3. So we know our asymptotes are going to be centered at minus 1 on the real axis. Okay. We know their angle. It's 2k plus 1. This is 3 again. It was 1. Out into the series. Okay, well, starts at 0, right? Yeah. 0, 1, and we'd have 2, all right? So at 0, what's our asymptote angle?
60.
K equal 1, what's our asymptote angle? 180. K equals 2. Right, we get to 2, right?
3.
3, yeah. You also write 300 minus 60. So we know we have some asymptotes now. They're going to start at minus 1. We have 1 at 180. Right? And we have 1 at 60 and 1 minus 60. So just imagine that 60 degrees. So we have some asymptotes to our plot now. It's going to kind of confine our third locus. So that was step 3, what we just did. Okay. We're going to hold on to step 4 for a second. Okay. Let's look at the breakaway points. Okay. Let's take our Let's take this equation, And we're going to have and then what I want to do, I want to get into some form that it looks like that. K is some function of S. Well, what I can do, I multiply top and bottom by this guy, right? And that allows me, it's going to just end up being after some algebra. Skip a step. Okay. So I have now K written as a function of S, like we wanted. And to find these breakaway points, I just set dk ds to 0. And find the values of S that makes that true. Okay. And I'll save the algebra, I think. Let's see. Yeah, I'll save the algebra. In this case, we're going to get 4. Approximately. All right. So we have two candidates for breakaway points, actually. Which one of these actually lies on the locus? Or maybe both of them do. Yeah, only the first one lies on the locus. Right. So this is the only place where it could actually break away. Right. So point 4, 2, we know we have a kind of special point there. Right. This is where that locus would break off the real axis. And as you might expect, to approach the asymptotes from there. Okay, so in this case, this guy, we just ignore him.
Would it necessarily intersect the asymptotes, or no?
No, they're asymptotes. You approach them.
Okay.
Yeah. You get infinitely close to them, but you never get there. Okay, so we got our breakaway point. All right, so now I want to figure out, so we've got, let's go back over here, we've done 2, we did 3, took care of 1 already, we still have 4 left to do. Do we have any complex conjugate poles or zeros? Right, so that guy doesn't even apply in this case. We found breakaway points. So all we need to have, all that's left to do for us is to figure out where it crosses the imaginary axis. Okay. So that tells us effectively how steeply we're approaching those asymptotes. Right? Are we just approaching them somewhere way out here, or are we getting close to them quickly? All right. So one way to do that is to take excuse me. And I'm going to take this guy and we're going to rewrite it so you multiply around the collect terms, you can write it in that form. Just took this guy. And you can multiply that out, which I'll do quickly, which I already did. Okay. So we have that as being true. We're going to plug in I omega for S. Right? So we end up with okay. What's I omega cubed?
Negative omega cubed.
It's omega squared or cubed. What's... no, you got an I there.
Negative I.
Yep, you got an I there. All right. What's I omega squared?
Negative omega squared.
Right, and we have 3 times that. So I have a complex equation again. I can collect real and imaginary terms. Okay. What has to be true for that equation to be true? Let me help you. Both the real and imaginary parts both need to be zero. So now I have 2 equations, 2 unknowns. I can figure out what omega and what k this thing would cross the imaginary axis on. What does the omega tell me? Why is that showing up here? Yeah, so the distance from the origin, right, remember, is omega on these pole zero maps. So that kind of gives me information of how far up the axis it happens, right? And then with the k value that's associated with that point tells me the gain that happens at. All right, so in this case, I have 2 solutions. Step through a little bit of the algebra to practice your quadratic equation skills in the notes. So I have one place where it kind of touches the imaginary axis, right? There. Right? Another place at plus or minus, so these end up being something like that, let's say. All right? Plus or minus square root of 2. And now I have everything I need to do. So this approaches that asymptote out here somewhere. And that one approaches that asymptote up there somewhere. Right. And we know k equals 6 at those 2 places where we cross the imaginary axis. So if we're designing this controller, we better make sure k stays less than 6. Right. And we probably would want it much less than 6 so that we're back here somewhere, away from that axis. All right. All right, so that's the root locus method. What we'll see is happening is there are patterns in poles and zeros, and you kind of get a feel for that. So I think you show this pole zero map of the open loop poles to a controls person, I could have just sketched that without going through the actual calculations. And so you can start seeing, just getting in some kind of intuitive idea, what's going to happen if I change this gains? Does this ever go unstable? You can get some really quick information by just being able to sketch these rough approximations of them even, as long as you're in the ballpark. And that's what we'll get to for these. Right? Of course, the tools to sketch and analyze and do all kinds of detailed analysis for the root locus is also built into nearly every control system toolbox on the planet, including the Python one we use. So we can sketch and get first approximations and kind of get some intuition about what the controller should look like. We'll see that some controllers add poles and zeros to the open loop transfer function. So we can look at what would be the effect if I put a zero here or there in the pole zero mapping to the root locus. And then as a result of that, how the response changes if I do that. And again, of course, you can do that more analytically with the numerical tools. Question, yeah. Yeah, so what's happening here is this guy is going here and down. This one is going there and up. So you actually have 1, 2, 3.
So you do have a possibility, though, that your closed loop pole could be on the real axis between 0 and 0.4.
In that case, you'd have your closed loop. You could have one there, one there, one would be somewhere there. Right. Keep increasing k. You'd have one there, one farther left out here. Right. Increase k some more. One there, one even farther out there. Closed loop poles. K equals 6 is right when it crosses, so we'd be marginally stable when K is 6. K is any bigger than 6 at all. We have poles in the right half plane, we're unstable.
So, I guess, how would you get that first thing that you showed me, where one is in between 0 and 0.4 and the other one is? Yeah. What value of K, I guess, would, or how do you know where you would break off?
Yeah, so if you look, let's see. KDS 0. Analytically, let me get back to you. Okay. In practice, what you do is you end up with a locus. You can get this numerically, and they get more complex, obviously. Most of them will let you vary K and show you how the poles are moving as K is changing. Like, a lot of them will have this like a little slider, slide K back and forth. And it shows you how the closed loop poles move along this guy. Okay. Where would we probably want the poles here? Where are some good places? We got 2 minutes, don't we? Yeah, okay. Not anywhere near 6, that's true.
On the real axis is not bad.
On the real axis is not bad. Don't have any oscillation. Sure. How do I want this pole to move? Let me ask that a different way. As I'm increasing this, so I start open loop pole, I start increasing the gain, I'm moving this way with this first closed loop pole. What's happening to that part of the response as I'm moving left? Well, the damping is always the same because I'm still on the real axis. Right. So what's happening to the response? What does moving left on this plane mean in terms of response?
Settling time, right? Or
it has some effect on settling time, sure.
Well, if it settles, well. Your response happens.
You could think of it as more stable. You can think of it that way.
Your response happens quicker.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. That's the highest level thing. As I move farther left on this plane, the faster things are happening. So this is slow, this pole at 0. I want to get him farther left if I can, so the system responds faster. Right? And I can do that up until here.
So you want it somewhere as far left as possible, but also close to the real axis.
If you want a system that's heavily damped, yeah. So it could be some systems where you want it to be able to overshoot a little bit and then settle. So then you might start moving up a little bit away. It depends on the specs, yeah. But we can even get, you can start to get some understanding of how should I increase my gains just by kind of looking at this intuitively. I want to move stuff left. But if I, you know, and that might tell you I want to just crank the gain up so I can go faster. Well, you can look at this and say, well, if we crank the gain up too high, we're going to be in trouble. Right? And even before I start going unstable, I'm going to start oscillating quite a lot. Right? My damping starts going down as I pick up K in the system. Selling time goes up and everything, right? So this kind of is a good example of I don't just always want to crank the gains up as high as I can. In this case, a more conservative gain is probably going to get you a better response. And again, you know, if you do this a little while, you can be able to sketch that out in 30 seconds without having to even do all of this math and get some intuitive feel on what the gain structure needs to be for your system. And of course, if, you know, you don't have your job, you go back and actually do the analysis, but you can get some direction on where you should be going by a 30-second sketch, but just thinking about the problem on an intuitive level, rather than just blindly going through a method. Okay, I think we're out of time.
On the website, buy it, it says due tonight, so on the paper, it's up for due tonight.
If the paper says Wednesday, go buy the paper. That was a mistake, but yeah, go buy the paper. Got an extra day.